brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and Straight Talk with the Guys in the Community.
Everyone, welcome back to Soft Rep Radio. I'm your host today, Steve Balistrieri. Soft Rep Radio on time, on target. We always try to bring you the best of what's going on out there in the world. And today we have a very special guest with us, Justin Adi, who just finished a book. It's called Eagle Down, The Last Special Forces Fighting in the Forever War. It was a absolutely fantastic read. It was a little concerning, a little upsetting, I guess you could say, as a former Special Forces guy. And we're going to get into the reasons for all that. But Jess was the Wall Street Journal's person on the ground, I guess you could say, their bureau chief in Afghanistan for about 4 years. Excuse me. So she definitely spent her time there. She was embedded with the Afghan SF guys, with the American SF guys. She has a fantastic story to tell. We're going to get into that in her book. But before we do any of that, we want to welcome her to the podcast. Jess, thank you for taking the time, I should say this evening, because you're joining us from the beautiful country of South Africa today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it is our pleasure. And I just wanted to ask you real quick, I know prior to going to Afghanistan, you spent some time in Libya during the fall of Gaddafi and the civil war there. Was it a big difference for you? I know Libya was your first war that you covered. Was it a big difference going from, let's say, Libya to Afghanistan?
For me, it was a huge difference. Not just on a personal level, because one thing is when you've never been in a war before, to find yourself in a war for the first time, that causes quite a big sort of personal development. But the Libyan war in 2011, when I was there, was completely chaotic. You didn't know who controlled what. The country was split into an insert where you had Gaddafi's forces fighting off a very sort of ragtag alliance of different Libyan militias. In Afghanistan, when I got there for the first time, which was in 2012, it felt like a war that had been set in for a long time. Everybody knew where they stood. You had every country in the world, it felt like, with a stake, with a sort of role on the stage. And you knew, this road is under this control, the government has this, the Taliban has that. And so it felt a lot more organized, and it felt a lot safer as well.
Oh, it did. Yeah, because I know, at that time in Libya, and again, I'm bouncing back and forth, but it seemed like, as you said, very chaotic, and they probably didn't have any safe, I don't want to say safety nets, but like where, journalists were probably kind of embedded more with the war in Afghanistan, where probably in Libya, you guys were left to fend for yourselves.
Yeah, we were totally on our own. I mean, in Libya, we didn't have a bureau. Nobody had a bureau. Journalists just worked out of one of a couple of hotels in town. There was almost no supervision and very little security in terms of, I was with Reuters at the time, and they had one security guy in Tripoli for a huge number of reporters, photographers, TV people. So you were very much left on your own. It was very risky, and you had a lot of freedom. I mean, you could jump in a cab and go, to Misrata, which is another town like 2 hours away. So it was pretty chaotic. But I mean, even in Afghanistan, we were very much left to operate on our own. Unlike sort of big, diplomatic missions or companies, as a journalist, you are basically the person there. You're on your own. I lived in a shared house with the journalist that worked for the Washington Post and somebody else that rented a room from us. And I was, free to make up my day as I wanted to do. And if I wanted, the only sort of regulations that we had were if you were going to leave the city of Kabul, you had to plan the trip with our security advisor and get it signed off at headquarters, and the idea was that the story had to be considered worth whatever risk you were taking, and any trip outside of Kabul towards the end especially was considered high risk. But you came up with your own security plan, pretty much. You know, you explained to them how you were going to make sure that you made it there and back in one piece.
Interesting. You know, and reading the book, I think I came away with probably the same perspective that a lot of former military, especially special forces guys, probably have. And to me, the biggest question of this book are, why are American special forces guys still in Afghanistan? And what are they really doing? Because, you know, we tend to think of these guys, they have a plan and they're going to go in and they're going to do their mission, do their job, I guess you could say. But in the book, it's so confusing. And to me, that was like, it was very eye-opening.
To me, it seemed especially in the earlier years, sort of 2015 onwards, you had the Obama administration saying that the war was over. They had delivered on this campaign pledge. There were fewer than 10,000 troops. They called it a training mission instead of a combat mission. And it seemed to me that the focus was very much to make it look like the U.S. was no longer at war. And at the same time, you had the reality on the ground, which was a fast declining security situation with the Afghan government forces unable to hold on to major population centers on their own. And so you had to figure out how to back them up. And obviously the answer came in the form of special operations, because they're special operations, you don't have to embed journalists with them. You don't have to really account for what they're doing. You just sort of say, well, it's a counterterrorism mission or it's a training mission, and that's that. And you don't really know what's going on. And unfortunately, unless you're somebody who's, you know, maybe a journalist that's been working there for a long time or following the conflict very closely, the average person doesn't really have any idea what U.S. troops are actually doing or why. Because it's no longer talked about. And to me, it seems that their sort of principal role has been to keep Afghanistan out of the headlines, to prevent the losses of major population centers, and to sort of keep the two sides, the government and the Taliban and insurgent side, sort of fairly balanced on the battlefield. The idea, obviously, is so that at this point, so that you can support peace talks. But back then, there weren't even peace talks going on. And so that's what brought me to decide to write the book, because I thought it was important there should be some kind of discussion over the way special operations were being used, and, you know, whether there was any kind of long-term strategy.
Yeah, and you know, to me, that was the most disturbing part of the book is, you know, we put these guys in harm's way. And I say we as a country, I mean, we send them there. They're in a provincial capital that's under attack by the Taliban. These guys are in pretty pitched combat. They have wounded troops. They have air assets all around them, and they're not allowed to use them. And that to me was shocking. I'll admit it. I was under the impression that right up until today, these guys had, you know, everything at their disposal and they were able to use it. And of course, in the book, it comes out that they weren't, and it may have, you know, contributed to some guys getting hurt.
Yeah, I think that was the feeling, especially earlier on before the Trump administration came in. There were extremely strict rules on what kind of support these troops could have. So unless they were sort of, you know, on the brink of total disaster, they wouldn't get the air support. And the idea or the logic in Washington, which, you know, always makes a lot more sense when you're in Washington and it's sort of all neatly organized, you need to say, well, you know, you have to limit support because otherwise the Afghans are never going to do it on their own. Whereas the reality is that nothing really that Washington is going to do is going to change how willing the Afghan forces are or how capable really they are to provide support in a particular operation. So these guys were getting put in very dangerous situations without the support that they would normally get. Aside from that, I mean, another thing that was common was because the administration had planned to pull all troops out, and because they supposedly weren't in combat anymore, they didn't have some of the resources that they would usually have, you know, like the ability to drop supplies with a GPS guided supplies, right? So they would just push things out of an airplane and they would land wherever, and then they had to go find them in the middle of you know, a Taliban-controlled village, rather than be able to guide them to the exact place where they were. So there were other factors that further exposed them. When the Trump administration came in, they did relax some of the restrictions, which brought some relief, and of course then tightened them up again once the deal was signed.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book that the Afghan, you know, special operations guys that the U.S. trained, they're really spread awfully thin, and that was a major issue, and it was an issue with those guys. And in fact, a couple of times that, you know, it seemed like they were, I don't want to say losing their will to fight, but they were getting very frustrated themselves over this.
Yeah, I mean, the Afghan commandos, even more than police and the army forces, I mean, they come under a lot of criticism because they're seen as not wanting, they don't want to fight, or they give up along the way. But what you have to remember is that unlike, you know, American troops who can cycle in and out every 6 months or however long, these guys are stuck for the long haul. You know, we embedded with commandos that had been commandos pretty much in the same position for 10 years. You know, they were incredibly experienced, incredibly smart, perceptive guys who were alive by miracle, and most of the people they had started out with were no longer alive. And, you know, they're in the same position where they're being sent out to basically rescue, you know, villages and district centers from the Taliban to make it look like that the government isn't losing. And they're seeing the same places fall over and over again, and they're being sent back to the same places, and they can go and drive the Taliban out. But the problem is there's no plan after that to ensure the place doesn't fall back under insurgent control. So it's very demoralizing for them. And at a certain point, you know, their own sense of survival has to kick in. The other thing that is also important to remember is that they don't have any nice benefit system waiting for them when they get back. Or if they die, you know, nobody's going to look after their family. If they get wounded, they're pretty much left on their own. Or they can be helped out by contacts that they might have. But chances are, you know, it's ruinous for them. So you can understand why they're reluctant to put themselves on the line.
Right. And, when you're looking at these Afghan commandos, I mean, it seems like they're the best fighting force that the Afghans have, but there's just not enough of them. And, you know, we're always talking about the Afghans standing on their own, but it seems like once the U.S. does pull out, these guys are going to be really hard pressed to hold on to a lot of their areas, because it seems like they're the firemen going from one hotspot to another.
Yeah, I mean, they are exactly like firemen. And the problem is it takes a lot of time to build, a commando. And while the government has tried to increase the production of them, the quality isn't going to be as good because they won't have had as much training. In earlier years, the commandos worked very closely with U.S. Special Forces. Obviously, as the number of U.S. Special Forces has gone down, so has that level of interaction, which also reduces the amount of training that they have. So you have more commandos which are less trained acting as firemen. It's not a sustainable situation, or at least it's not a situation that's going to turn around things on the battlefield in the way that is hoped. And once the U.S. leaves, you know, they're going to leave not just with the troops, but the air support they provide, the transport support. You know, some of the Afghans rely on the U.S. to be able to sort of ferry fighters into the battlefield, along with providing air support and intelligence support. So all of that will go. And these guys, I mean, likely to have limited loyalty to the Kabul administration, which is seen to be horribly corrupt, and their own military leadership, which is also seen to be pretty corrupt, where they steal food, uniforms, vacation time, that sort of thing. So rather than seeing perhaps them vanish, you might see fighters gravitate towards who they see as their natural leader, whether it's by tribal association or ethnicity or some other thing.
We're speaking today with Jess Donati, the author of Eagle Down, The Last Special Forces Fighting in the Forever War, here on Soft Rep Radio. And Jess, there was a couple of very compelling characters. That all of the characters were compelling, but a couple of them I wanted to mention, because we could probably spend days and days talking about everybody that's in the book. But obviously, Hutch was a focal point in the book. And how difficult was it to get him to open up to you and talk about what actually went down, especially in the part of the mission that went bad during the retaking of one of the provincial capitals?
Yeah, I think that, the way that I got to know Hutch was through a different story that I was researching. I had heard his name sort of in these circles of contractors in Kabul, so I knew who he was. But I was investigating a story about a former Green Beret who was trying to raise an anti-Islamic state militia in the east, and that effort had gone horribly wrong. They had ended up decapitating these ISIS fighters and putting their heads on piles of rocks. It was very gruesome. He got into lots of trouble, but he claimed to have support from American special forces. And so the person he claimed supported him was Hutch. So I reached out to Hutch and I said, would you like to explain why you guys have been supporting a militia that decapitates people and puts their heads on rocks? And he was very worried that another very negative story would come out about U.S. Special Forces, and that, soon after the bombing of the MSF hospital. And so that's how I initially got to speak to him. And he clarified some of the details of that story. So as it turned out, the guy had been vastly overstating the amount of support that he had from the U.S. military. I was always fascinated by Hutch's story because we had heard so much about everybody else involved in that incident, but no one had ever heard from the soldiers who were involved. And I was really interested to know his viewpoint and how he, I guess, lived with what had happened and how he viewed it. And over the years, as I got to know more Green Berets that had fought at the time and convinced a critical mass of them to participate in the book, I asked him if he would do it, and he agreed. And I think, I think the thing that soldiers most worry about when they speak to journalists is that journalists are going to have an agenda, or that they have some motivation for it. And for me, I really just wanted to tell part of the Afghan war that I felt wasn't being represented anymore in the news, because journalists no longer had access to special operations and the government was no longer really saying what they were doing, and they did have this critical part. And so I wanted to be as fair and balanced as possible. And that was, and I guess that finally convinced the guys to participate.
Right. And during this one operation, I believe the way it's pronounced, Kunduz, I think it is, the operation there, what happened was the Afghan commandos had come under fire. They had identified a target for an airstrike, and there was a mistake made, and the target ended up being a hospital with Doctors Without Borders, and it went horribly wrong. But rather than trying to find out what had happened and interviewing the soldiers, it seemed like the higher ups in Kabul immediately declared it a war crime and went after Hutch. And they kept asking him, and you mentioned it in the book, that you want to change your story? And they were accusing him basically of lying. And mm-hmm. It was before even all the events had come out. And then later on, after the fact, that he was proven correct, but it was still a horrible mistake. And that was one of the more compelling parts of the book, because in it, you're not only getting his perspective as you talk to him, but his wife back in the States you know, he's talking to her on the phone and she's like, well, they're already calling it a war crime here. And it was just a terrible, terrible incident. And no one came out on top on that one.
No, it wasn't. And I think that was one of the incidents that did breed a certain amount of resentment amongst the ranks of sort of the of soldiers on the ground at Hutch's level and below, because they felt that they'd been thrown under a bus, because you had, you know, that this major city falls to the Taliban. You've got pictures on Twitter of the Taliban sort of partying in the middle of Kunduz, and you send in these guys who've never been to Kunduz before on this very dangerous mission to rescue the city. And then when something goes wrong, you then act like they are war criminals and you don't take any responsibility for the fact that you have come up with a plan to leave Afghanistan that's not sustainable, because the problem was the dynamic that the Americans had withdrawn support from Afghan forces, and Afghan forces were not ready to hold on to the territory that they were supposed to hold on, and the US wasn't prepared to let it go. You know, another way that could have turned out was the US could have said, okay, they lost Kunduz, we're going to step back because, as we said, we're no longer involved in this war, and things would have turned out differently. But they weren't prepared to both let go of the war and the fighting.
Yeah, and that, you know, because at that point, like 2014, 2015, you know, the government is telling us, you know, we're not at war anymore in Afghanistan. And there's the famous saying at that time was, there's no boots on the ground. I remember hearing that quite often in the news. But there were boots on the ground. And it seemed like I'll just call it like I see it. It seemed like that the higher-ups in Kabul were setting these special forces A-teams up to fail.
Yeah, I think they were, I think there were a lot of the missions that they did, and especially sort of later on, if you look towards what was going on in later years, I mean, they did, the missions did succeed in the short term. I mean, even in Kunduz, even with the disastrous bombing of the hospital, they did get the city back under Afghan government control. There still was very little information out about the role that the US had actually had. And the whole aim of keeping these secret was to make it look like the Afghan government had done it, but mostly by themselves. And so from that perspective, I mean, you could say the missions had succeeded, but they hadn't. There was no long-term success built into it, because there was no plan to avoid losing the city again and having to send the ODAs back in over and over again to the same places.
Right. And, you know, that, as you mentioned earlier, you mentioned that there was some hard feelings between some of the soldiers and, you know, either the government or their military headquarters. And, you know, one of the quotes that I wrote down from the book, because, I mean, I thought it was quite telling, where, you know, one of the troops said, we don't know what our goals are because they keep changing all the time. You don't know what we're supposed to be doing, yet you keep sending us out on crazy missions where we could all die for no reason. And that isn't something you would normally hear from SF troops when they're talking to their commanders.
Right. Yeah. And that soldier ends up stepping on a mine in Sangin during an operation whose purpose is not really clear. I mean, you know, why the US was out on a clearing operation in Sangin when they weren't supposed to be at war anymore, you know, is a question. And that's how it was. As things worsened in Afghanistan, the rules changed. The rules that were sort of being made in Washington changed. And as they were handed down, the soldiers weren't really given any explanation. For them, it was more like, okay, from not going out at all, now they're being told that they have to go out, you know, every week and do an operation, which is without any bigger goal other than to just do an operation and clear something or yeah. So I think it was very confusing for them.
Yeah, and for somebody who spent so much time in Afghanistan, I believe it was like 4 years of your life that you spent there. You know, one of the things that I've always been fascinated by, and I wanted to ask you just your personal opinion on this, having been there, you know, for so many years. The U.S. changed their mission to kind of a nation building type of thing, where it seemed like Afghanistan has always been a tribal society. Do you see, just this is just your personal opinion, do you see this changing for the Afghans? I mean, are they actually going to pull together as a country, or is it going to remain a tribal society for years to come, you think?
I mean, I think when you're there, you do see, for example, the influence left by the Soviets, right? Like there's older Afghans that speak Russian and have, you know, were sent to universities in Russia, and you see that kind of influence. And the same with the US. After 20 years of the US being there, you see a lot of US influence that has become part of Afghan society in in major cities. I mean, in Kabul, for example, for me, it was especially going back, the last time in 2019, there's cafes where, men and women are sitting together. You have one or two, I guess you could say, nightclubs where they can go listen to music and mix together. And there's absolutely no foreigners involved in this. This is just an Afghan thing. And so I think there are a lot of Western values that have filtered into society. But in the longer run, I mean, there's no way that the US can build a country in its own image or in any image. I mean, Afghanistan has a very long history with a lot of traditions. It's a very very diverse country, and so I mean, there's nothing they can do, the US can do, to decide how they should live. And the problem is, when the US leaves, the Afghans are going to have to figure out how to balance all of these influences amongst themselves, because you have in the South or in the East very conservative tribal societies that, their way of living, it's close to what we imagine the Taliban influence being, women in burqas and not going out. And that's something that's native, and it's not necessarily even a religious thing, that's more of a tribal thing. Whereas in cities over decades, you've seen liberal influences come and go. And so they're going to have to balance that somehow without the U.S.
So, and looking at Afghanistan as a whole, things have changed, obviously, several times since our first troops hit the ground in 2001. And one of them was the introduction of ISIS into the country and the Islamic State. And, we kind of, in the United States here, most of the people kind of lump ISIS and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban all into a big cauldron, and like they're all the same, but they're really not. And, they're kind of like the interlopers, because they've got some their support from former Taliban members. What's the feeling with the Afghan government and the Taliban for what you can glean from your time there about how they feel about ISIS?
I mean, I think there's a lot of confusion and uncertainty over what ISIS really means in Afghanistan. The links between ISIS headquarters, say, in Iraq, Syria, are unclear. I mean, there are sort of isolated reports of money passing from one group to the other, a certain amount of training, some ideology, but generally there's not a very clear link. And when you see one of the troubling things when you're looking at the Afghan war is that you see a lot of attacks or high profile attacks blamed on ISIS, and you don't really have any claim from ISIS other than, a day later ISIS in Syria puts out a statement. There's no real evidence that ISIS actually had a role. So we don't really know a lot about them there, but there was an ISIS spokesman. There was a group initially formed out of the Pakistani Taliban. The spokesman was killed in a US drone strike within a month or so of becoming the spokesman, and no one's really heard from the Afghan group since. So there's not really been any reliable journalist interviews with them directly, and so we just don't know. And one of the examples is with the recent spate of attacks that you've seen in Kabul now. I mean, so many different groups have an interest in destabilizing Kabul, making it look like it's chaos. So when you're looking at an attack and you're blaming it on ISIS, it might well be some disgruntled government official or some warlord or something. I mean, there's never, you can never really be sure unless you investigate each specific attack, whether it really was carried out by the person who claimed it. And the Afghan government has had an interest in playing up ISIS in the country because that keeps the Americans interested. And to a certain extent, you know, perhaps the Americans have also had an interest in making it seem like ISIS is this very defined entity, because then it gives you a very defined reason for staying.
Right. And that was one of the comments that President Biden made recently, where he was like, the counterterrorism mission will continue. But it's kind of a murky thing, because who's, you know, what missions are going to go on there? But I guess that's a topic for a different time. But as a woman, how difficult was it working, being embedded with the Afghan, you know, commandos? Was there any pushback on there, or did they welcome you?
I mean, for me, the reporting that I did was possible because I had an excellent Afghan colleague, Habib Khan Totakhel, who I would do these embeds with. And he was a Pashtun guy. He looked like a Talib, you know, long beard, long hair, but he was quite a hippie at heart. And, you know, he was basically keeping me safe there. He would tell me when a situation was good or bad. You know, he'd be able to read the room for me. He was able to get access from the Ministry of Defense. And because you had, there was actually quite a bureaucratic process to embed with Afghan forces, which, you know, because they were built in the image of American forces, you'd have all these forms to fill out. So he was very good at navigating the Ministry of Defense. And so it was possible that way. I mean, Afghan commandos, Afghan men in general, you know, they don't see Western women quite like Afghan women. They sort of see them as a sort of third gender almost. And so you do get access. People will talk to you. You know, sometimes they don't even want to talk to you because they're curious and they maybe haven't seen a woman for months or years or who knows how long. And so so you do. Obviously, there are other risks as a woman. So you don't really want to be walking around a commander base by yourself, you know. But
and having your guide there, the way you described him in the book, he seemed like he was I'm not say threatening, but he would kind of deter anyone from taking liberties with you.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't want it to sound like I'm not appreciative of the hospitality that we receive, because, you know, a lot of the Afghan commandos, especially, you know, we would be attached to, you know, like some captain level sort of guy, and they would really be very hospitable. They would, you know, arrange all of our meals and take us out on, you know, patrols and give us the, you know, full view of what was going on. They were very interesting people. So, I think it was, he just kind of helped me, I guess, fit in, and he helped mm-hmm. the commanders open up, and he, you know, kept me out of trouble when I was there, you know, saying, well, you know, don't go down that hallway, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Right, right. Now, did you wear the traditional woman's garb over there?
Yeah, I mean, if even when I was with the Afghan, you know, embedded with the Afghan soldiers, I always wore an abaya, which is like a long black cloak. It's popular in sort of Saudi Arabia, and which over my clothes, and I would wear an Afghan tunic underneath. And then obviously a headscarf. If we were going out and sort of trying to report from, you know, if we were going to sort of see an Afghan militia out in the middle of nowhere or do reporting in very remote areas, then I would wear an Afghan tunic, the abaya, and a burqa over it. Because once you're under a burqa, you know, people tend not to bother you or notice you. And so that was my way of getting around places that were more dangerous.
Did you ever feel in danger working over there at different times?
Oh, I mean, yeah, there were a lot of times where we would felt in danger. You know, you were only as we relied a lot on local sort of contacts and fixtures. And so, if you're going somewhere very remote like Kunar, and you're going in the car and you're driving in a you know, in your Toyota Corolla, you know, you're hoping that you don't get stopped at a checkpoint or Taliban checkpoint. You know, we've driven into a couple of ambushes. You know, one of them, our car was damaged because we drove into, or rather, the insurgents in the mountaintops opened fire down on the road where we were, not firing at us, but at a police convoy that happened to pass us. And so we had like a flat tire and stuff from that, and a broken engine. So we broke down in Sarobi, which is a very insecure area. And we obviously had nobody coming to get us. So we had to take the Toyota to like a local garage. And I just sat there in my burqa for hours, you know, hoping that no one would wonder who we were. And so, yeah, there were lots of times when it felt insecure, and it was really just down to luck, because other journalists over the years that I was there would be doing sort of something similar and it would go wrong. So, you know, part of it is planning. You try and plan for every outcome. You try and make sure you have all the information on the road that you're traveling on, and that, you know, your local contacts, you know, whether it's the local provincial district governor or whatever. Or, you know, a local journalist or something helping you, you know, that they're reliable and they can be trusted not to sort of sell you to the enemy, I suppose.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking about the U.S. Special Forces guys in the book, was there any pushback on, I'd say, from like the Special Operations Command for them not to cooperate with it?
I mean... It was really a sort of grassroots effort. Like when I went to sort of headquarters to ask for interviews with people like General Swindell, they were denied. And so it was more a case of reaching out to people individually, and then they would reach out to their public affairs person. And I did have an approval from the military public affairs, which sort of said that, you know, that they were supposed to cooperate and help with my research, and that they supported the publication of the book. So I did have that kind of official stamp, but I didn't get a lot of support from headquarters. But I did at the lower level, yes. I mean, public affairs guys would be like, yeah, sure, you know, talk to so-and-so. And they would sit in on the interview and they wouldn't interfere generally. They were really supportive in that respect.
And one of the... another really compelling part of the book, you talked at length about Caleb, the special operator that lost both of his legs, and, you know, his story going through all of his, you know, struggles and travails of learning to walk again and all that. Have you been in contact with him since the book's been out? And how's he doing?
I mean, he's good. He's found his calling in helping other people. So he's teaching archery, and he's a really, really impressive guy because he's so thoughtful and so reflective on things. And he knows, he has a good way, I think, of viewing what happened to him and sort of coming to terms with it. He's got an amazing family. He's got two little girls who are amazing. And he's very, you know, and he's very open. And so he'll say, you know, I mean, I found it really, really good to work with him. And we do keep in touch.
That's great. And his wife seemed like a very, very strong woman.
Very strong woman, very impressive woman. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how she managed. I mean, I have a baby myself now, and I don't know how any of the wives manage now that I'm in a sort of in the position of parenting. I just can't imagine doing what they did.
Now your baby's quite young, right? You didn't have any children when you were over in Afghanistan.
No, I did not. And so, I've got a 6-month-old baby. So no more trips to Afghanistan for me for a while.
That's the fun age when they're 6 to 10 months old. I look back on that. My son's now 22. So, you know, yeah. I probably am looking through rose colored glasses. But I love that stretch, you know, from the six months to a year was part of my favorite time, I thought.
Yeah, it's great. It's a wonderful time. And it's also, you know, it's good to have two parents in the house because otherwise you end up with no time. And so I don't know how these women manage, you know, worrying about their husbands never coming back or dealing with the injuries like Caleb had with, you know, one, two small kids. Tina was pregnant when Hutch was over in the mission in Kunduz. I mean, I can't imagine doing what they did. I find that so impressive.
Yeah, they the women in the book, that again, that was, you know, one of the better parts of the books, because, you know, not only are you getting the story of the soldiers, you're getting their families back home. And, you know, the women, I thought, were really strong in this. And your heart goes out to some of the guys who end up getting killed, because, you know, most of the American public, we see just the aftermath. You might see a picture of a funeral where somebody's getting a folded flag, but there's a lot more to that, and the family's there.
I mean, I know that, for example, Alexandra McClintock, whose husband was killed in Marja. I mean, I know that she hasn't read the book. She hasn't read. I mean, as I was writing, before publication, obviously sent the chapters over to the people that were in it so that they had a chance to correct anything that was inaccurate or weigh in. And she didn't read them because, I mean, 5 years on, it's still such an awful thing to have gone through. You know, and I think people, when they talk about, oh, well, we're only losing, you know, 10 US soldiers a year or 20. I mean, you know, what are we losing them for? And do we really consider the impact of the loss of just a single soldier, really? And that's one of the things that I wanted to convey in the book.
Right. And, you know, speaking in general terms, do you think that journalism is changing the way wars are covered nowadays? I mean, because we live in that era, you know, back in World War II and even in Vietnam, it was like, you know, far in the distance, and you'd have to rely on newspapers back in World War II, or, you know, the radio, and you'd get reports that were maybe a day or two old. And then in Vietnam, it started coming into our, you know, living rooms at night. But today, I mean, we're seeing stuff as it unfolds. And is journalism changing the way we look at wars now?
I think that it's more the other way around. I think that in earlier years in Afghanistan and in Iraq, obviously, you had journalists embedding with a range of different troops for a length of time that gave them a chance to really see or understand what was going on. Since 2015, when the Afghan war was, when there was this effort to put the Afghan war out of the public, you know, journalists don't really get to embed with US forces, and the very few embeds that are granted only to, you know, a couple of DC journalists who haven't got a lot of in-depth experience in Afghanistan, and they don't get a lot of time to spend with these troops. So, you know, you don't really learn a lot just by being there for 2 days or so, or 3 days. And so I think that really makes it difficult for journalists to really cover what the war is like now. And so it has unfortunately sort of faded out of the public's mind.
Yeah, it's very true. I mean, you know, we see it every day here in the States. But, you know, the book, and again, to our listeners out there, we're talking with Jess Donati. She wrote the book Eagle Down, the last special forces fighting in the Forever War. And really, I mean, after reading the book, this should be required reading, I think, for our government leaders and military war colleges, because it shows what can happen, and it can happen quite easily when we strip our special operations forces or anyone involved in that kind of situation of their assets, and, you know, we're putting their lives in harm's way. And I can't tell you how much I thought I was impressed with your work in this, and I thought it was a fantastic book. And like I said, at times it was very uplifting, and at other times it was very concerning, I guess, when we see what our guys are going through on a daily basis, and I think you captured that, and our hats are off to you, and we, you know, encourage all of our readers, all of our listeners, to definitely check out the book. It's available on Amazon.com, and it's also available, I believe, off of your website, correct?
Yeah, there's a list of sellers from the publisher's website, from Hachette, and so pretty much all booksellers should be able to get a copy if you don't want to go down the Amazon route.
Great, and we don't want to take up too much more of your time. I know you have a young baby at home, and is your husband a journalist as well?
Absolutely not. I would never date another journalist. he's in the Foreign Service. So.
Oh, okay.
He's currently handling the baby.
Oh, well, there you go. And that's that is a diplomatic chore in itself. So.
Yes. You haven't heard him screaming, I hope, but I can hear him from here.
Yeah. Well, I won't keep you any longer. Thanks for joining us this evening on your time and this morning on our time. But we really appreciate your insight, you taking the time to talk with us here at Software Up Radio. Again, we definitely encourage our readers and our listeners out there to check out the book. It's well worth it. But before you're quite welcome. Anytime. And is there anything before we go? Is there anything that on the agenda for you? Are you working on something new?
No, I'm going back to my job covering national security at the Wall Street Journal starting in March, and we'll see. We'll go from there.
Oh, excellent! So that means you'll be probably back in the States by then.
Yeah, heading back next week.
Excellent. Well. I know it must be tough leaving Africa because it's such a beautiful place, but we wish you all the best in that. And again, thank you for taking the time with us today.
But
before we go, I just wanted to read a quick note from our editors here. If you want to get SoftRep on your phone, download our free mobile app and get easy access to our articles, podcasts, and gear reviews, all perfectly formatted to your device. Please subscribe to SoftRep.com to get access to all our library of ebooks and our exclusive team room content forums and available on all your Apple and Android devices. Jess, thanks again for taking the time with us today. We really appreciate it. And all the best to you in the future.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It was our pleasure. All right. That's it for us here at SoftRep Radio. We'll be back with another podcast real soon. Until then, don't turn that dial, SoftRep Radio, on time, on target.
You've been listening to SoftRep Radio.